I want to say this, that I'm convinced more and more, certainly in our context in Durban, I don't know if it's the same where you are, but that part of gospel growth is transfer growth. In our country, because there are so many bad churches where the gospel is not preached, people who go to church need to get converted. And so transfer growth is something that we've made peace with. All of us, you know, because we are evangelistically minded, we want conversion growth. That's always first prize. But I've made peace with the fact that actually more of our growth comes from transfer growth, and that's okay, because in our country people are churched but not gospeled. And so transfer growth is gospel growth if they are coming to us from a church that doesn't preach the gospel, which is the case largely in our area. And so transfer growth is a key strategy, and we've got to plan for it, welcome it, and work with it, and not shun it as being kind of second best. And so a lot of our growth has taken place from people who've been churched but not gospeled. They come to us and they get gospeled, and it's quite a difficult thing to celebrate it when they become Christians, because if you went to them and said, "Do you know what, I think you've just become a Christian," they'd be highly offended, because they think they've been a Christian for 20 years, but actually they've just been churched for 20 years. And you've noticed something in them. Maybe lights have gone on, understanding has come, convictions maybe have been there for the first time, and you can see that they've been converted, but they think that they've been converted for many years. So it's a difficult thing to celebrate conversions from transfer growth, because people think that they're Christians. But we mustn't underestimate it or shun it, in my view. And so at CCU, we are passionately committed to growing in number. Did you hear that verse, verse 15, 2 Corinthians 4? It's all for your sake, so that as grace extends to more and more people, it may increase thanksgiving to the glory of God. We want grace to extend to more and more people, whether they're coming to us from other churches or whether they are coming to us as completely unchurched unbelievers, we don't mind. Grace needs to be extended, because as grace is extended, God gets more glory. Now, specifically this morning, so let me just say this. One of the mind shifts that I've had to undergo with regards to growth is that we do actually want a big church. So it's just worth saying that. We want a big church. We want our church to be getting bigger. And we want more people to come. And there was a bit of a mind shift for me, because it sounds so worldly to say that. And so I had to realize, actually, from places like 2 Corinthians 4, that actually that is the inner dynamo of the gospel, is that it does grow numerically, and that we want that growth, and we welcome it, and we seek it, and we plan for it, and we look to remove obstacles to that growth coming. And that was a liberating moment for me, and it's something that I had to grapple with, and I'm not sure where you are on that subject. The 200 barrier, growing beyond 200, it's a notorious barrier. And we idled around the 200 mark for a couple of years before we grew beyond it. Last year, I spent a week with a friend of mine in Australia. He's a Sydney Anglican ordained minister who's running one of the larger Anglican churches in Sydney, and his name is Raj Gupta. So can you imagine the mirth in my church when I told him I'm going to spend a week with the Guptas in Australia? No relation. He's just done his doctorate of ministry on the subject of why do Sydney Anglican churches struggle to grow beyond the 200 barrier. And in I was there for when he presented his doctorate of ministry, and so I owe a lot of this to him and to that doctorate. But what he discovered doing the stats on the Sydney Anglican Diocese, which is double the size of Reach SA. So the Sydney Anglican Diocese has about 250 churches, which is roughly sort of double our size. And what he discovered is that between the only 20 churches out of 250 that are bigger than 500 in the Sydney Anglican Diocese. And between the years of 2005 and 2015, there were only four churches that grew beyond the 200 barrier. Most of the Sydney Anglican Diocese churches are sub-200. Actually, most of them are sub-150. And what's interesting, one of the things that he uncovered and has challenged the authorities in the Anglican Diocese of Sydney with is the fact that they've got a fund, which they call the Greenfields Fund, which is millions of Aussie dollars set aside for when a new area is developed in New South Wales. They'll use that money to buy up land so that they can put a church there, which is very forward-thinking and wonderful resources that they've got. But what Raj discovered is that the planning that's gone into the Greenfields Fund is that they will only build churches. They're planning to build churches that only seat 150 people. So they're forward-thinking on the one hand, got a fund to buy up land in new areas. But there's a lot of frustration about the fact that the biggest that they're thinking is 150 people in a building. So they'll only buy a piece of land that can park and house 150 people. And so a few motions over the last couple of years have gone through synod to challenge that doctrine. And there's now some fresh thinking that's come into that. So in other words, they don't expect to grow beyond 150 because of the difficulty of getting bigger than that. So most churches, I'm told in America, that the average size of a church in America is between 80 and 95. We only hear about the mega churches. So it's a notorious barrier. There are certain things that can be done to remove obstacles to getting beyond that barrier. And I'm going to share with you some of our own personal experiences, but also incorporating some of the things that some of the literature, including Raj's own doctorate, has uncovered about this barrier. This one is the only one that deserves to be first. The rest are in no particular order of priority. But it must be an increasing evangelistic temperature in the local church, which sounds a little bit, we assume in our circles that we are evangelistically minded. But I've been reminded recently of how easy it is to slip away from that and from that evangelistic fervor. In his doctorate, he discovered that the consistent picture of the churches that he studied in the Sydney Anglican Diocese was that they didn't have evangelistic fervor. So if you had asked any of the leaders of those churches if they were committed to evangelism, they would have said yes, but it was undiscernible in the actual church. And so raising the temperature, using the natural things in the calendar like Easter and Christmas, to raise the evangelistic fervor, temperature in the church is a key thing to do. And one of the things that we've discovered is that we've copped quite a lot of flack for that. And so quite recently, but it's happened before recently as well, is that people will complain because the preaching in the church is evangelistic. And recently we've had a meeting with a guy who's said that he feels that the preaching at CCU has deteriorated over the last 3 years. And when we asked him why, he said, because all we ever hear is evangelism. What about the other things? And now he's got half a point. So obviously there's lots of other things that we can talk about. But the point that I think is mistaken on is the sufficiency of the gospel. And so we are persuaded that what Christians need to hear every week is the gospel. Because Romans 1, the gospel is what saves. And in Romans 16, the gospel is what establishes. It's not two different messages. We all know this. I'm not telling anything you don't know. But it's been recently revived in my own heart and in my own thinking to refuse to assume the gospel. So that the gospel is preached weekly, so that every Sunday is seen as an opportunity for the gospel to be clearly laid out, not only for non-Christians, but also for Christians. The gospel will save the lost and will establish the found. And so we've tried to work quite hard just on our calendar as a staff team to keep the evangelistic temperature up, because we want conversions. We want people to come to Christ, whether they're coming as churched people who become Christians or as unchurched people who get converted, doesn't matter. We want conversions. And so we make much of Easter. No one's allowed to go on holiday on the staff team. Christmas. We also have a very high point for evangelism in the middle of the year with our holiday Bible club, which is always followed by a guest sermon series of 3 or 4 weeks in the church. We run an evangelistic course, a Christianity Explored-like course, every single term. Every single term we run it. And we've also introduced a course that we've called Know and Tell the Gospel, based on Chapo's great book, which is designed to equip Christians to speak the gospel to their friends when the church scatters on Monday morning. And so increasing the evangelistic temperature is something that we've worked hard on and has resulted in fruit for which we are grateful. One of the things that we do to help our people get excited about evangelism is we celebrate conversions. And so almost every term, at the end of every term, we have a celebration evening in our church. I think Johan was saying a similar thing. They do it annually, and we do it every single, at the end of each term, the last Wednesday of the term is a celebrations evening. And for the last 6 or so months, terms, we've interviewed somebody who has become a Christian in that last term through our evangelistic course or in some other way. End of last term, which was 2 weeks ago, it was a 7-year-old girl who was part of our school's program, came to our church and became a Christian, and she gave her testimony, and it was a wonderful celebration in our church. So trying to acknowledge and celebrate conversions is something that we do every term, and we do it deliberately, and we're looking for it all term as well. Incidentally, for those of you who are team leaders, one of the things that somebody told me to do, and I've done it, and I'm so glad that we've done it, is every week we have our staff team, which is 9 of us, we have lunch together, and we call it our celebration lunch. And every week, every staff member has to come with a celebration from their area of ministry from the last week. And we go around in a circle and we just hear the celebration stories. Sometimes they're big, like a conversion. Sometimes they're small. And then we rejoice in one another's ministries. We rejoice in the work of God together. And it's been a great builder for our team and a unifier for our team, so that we can take an interest in each other's areas and then give glory to God. So I just recommend that to you if you're on a staff team. So, looking for conversions and increasing the evangelistic temperature of the church is a key step to growing beyond 200. Here are some other things. Again, none of this is rocket science. It's all in the literature. None of it is original to me. It's in books that I've read and conversations that I've had. But these are some things that have rung true in our own experience. Number one, and again, no order of priority from now on, but facilities. Can I just talk to you for a moment about facilities? Another mind shift that I've had to have is that facilities matter. I'm struck that in our circles, we don't think very much about people and space. And I think that that's wrong. I think the charismatics are ahead of us on that. People and space matters. And so building, expanding, relocating, or upgrading are the different ways in which facilities can help. CCU over the last 12 or so years before I was there has done all of those things. They've built, they've relocated, they've expanded, and recently we've upgraded our foyer. And just as a matter of interest, one of the things we've noticed is that when we upgraded our foyer, expanded it, made it bigger and more comfortable, that we've noticed that people stay for about 30 minutes longer after church. And are just loving the space, because I had a charismatic elder of a church who's an interior designer. I took him to our church before we expanded before we did the foyer, and I said to him, "Give me your honest opinion on the foyer." And he's a good mate of mine, and he said, "Permission to speak freely." I said, "Yes." He said, "I would never bring my friends here." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Because as you walk in the front door, there is the men's toilet window. You could have a guy literally at the urinal greeting people as they came in the door. Yeah. And you can see toilet rolls and air fresheners in the window. I wouldn't bring anybody out." And then he walked in and he said, "Tiles, you know, the tiles that we had on the floor, and we had some chrome furniture and interior face brick. He said, it's just cold. It's an undefined cold space. And so he did it for us, and the change in atmosphere, it's a difficult thing to articulate, but there's been an atmospheric change at church that has led to people staying longer and feeling more welcome. And so I just want to say to you that we need to accept the fact that just sociologically, facilities matter and people and space matters, and pull in a creative to help you think about that. And I thought we had great facilities until he came along. Second thing I want to say is providing more options. So we hit a plateau a few years ago. We had one morning service. It had reached capacity, not actually in the auditorium, but in the car park. And so we needed to launch a second morning service, which had never been done before. It took 3 years. So we did the morning service. We launched a second morning service, 7:45 and 9:30, which works where we live. And it took 3 years for our 9:30 service to build up, and we are now at pre-two services levels again at our 9:30 and wondering what to do next at that service. But what that did is it gave us space, and we now get about 140 people to the first service. So we've added 140 people, and we've filled the second service as it was before we split. We took 6 months to do it. And I had a very wise man on my council who understands leadership and management much better than I do. And he said to me, he made me read a book by John Cotter, who's not a Christian, called Leading Change. And I recommend it to you, where he puts out, so change management is a whole science and a discipline out there. And he gives you 8 steps for bringing about change in any organization. And so we followed those 8 steps. The first one is increasing urgency. So convince people that change is necessary. And so the way we did that is a friend of mine who flies drones took some pictures with his drones of our car park in the middle of our 9 o'clock service to show how full the car park was. And we put those pictures up for a couple of weeks and said to people, look how full our car park is. Isn't it wonderful? But there are only 180 of us here. We've worked out that there are 24,000 people in our ward who don't go to church on a Sunday. So we're not doing well at all, even though we feel full. And so we need to desperately do something about that. So increasing urgency is the first step for change management. And then there are some other steps as well that you can go and research yourself. John Cotter, Kotter, Leading Change. And so providing more options is my point. So we now have 3 services on a Sunday, and that's resulted in growth. Although it was slow initially, it took 3 years, and now we've got the same problem again 3 years later, which is a good problem to have, and we're trying to work out what to do. Here's another thing that we did, and that is taking the plunge and adding staff. So that helps as well. Somebody once said to me that staff is like marriage. Put everything into the selection process because you've got to live with it. And my staff team are here just to make sure I stay honest this morning. But selection of staff is a key thing. And one of the mind shifts that also we had to undergo is that the reason for staff is not to help the rector with his ministry. So I think how I used to think. So you get staff to do the things that I would rather not do or I'm too busy to do. But actually to appoint staff for their own ministry and for their own gifting. And so the rector becomes a supporter of that staff team and their ministries rather than viewing them as supporting his ministry. Now, I'm not saying that we mustn't have any support staff. But I'm saying the mind shift needs to be, I'm going to appoint staff for growth. I'm going to appoint staff for outcomes. I'm going to appoint staff for conversions. And if you've got that mind shift about your staff team, you'll find yourself saying to your staff, is there anything I can do to support you in your ministry? What can I do to help you in your ministry? So it's subtle, but it's quite a profound shift in thinking about staff team. And so I found with every staff member that we've appointed that I am busier, not less busy, because they need to be settled in and they need to they need help and they need to be met with and mentored and all of those things. So the appointment of staff is more work, not less work. So adding staff for growth, I know Nikki won't be embarrassed by this, but when we started 9 years ago, we appointed Nikki as our children's worker, and that became a real growth dynamic in our church. Because there wasn't a full-time children's worker before that, and the children's work had struggled with volunteers. Now we had somebody intentional, deliberate, and full-time in that role. The children's work grew, and that resulted in a growth dynamic. That's what you want with team members that are appointed. So adding staff. Under that heading comes another mind shift, and that is moving from a generalist to a specialist mindset. So being willing to appoint staff for specific roles on the church that you then give up. So is Stephen here? Stephen Gounder, where are you? He's in the back there. So Stephen will tell you, Stephen was appointed to our staff as looking after evangelism and mission, and it was what I used to do before he came onto the staff. I used to run the Christianity Explored on a quarterly basis, and I love it. It's my favorite thing. And you can ask, I mean, I gave it to Stephen and told him to run with it and do it better, which he's done and has had great fruit, I'm pleased to say. But a couple of times Stephen was in my office saying, are you really giving me this? Or are you going to interfere with it? And it was hard for me, you know. It was hard to let go of that because it's what I loved. And I grieved, actually. I grieved. And in order to really give it to him, I had to stay away from it because I'd get too excited and take over. And God has used that ministry, and it's been a wonderful thing, but it's because Stephen became a specialist in that area, and I backed off. And so that's been an important thing on our staff team for growth. And it's, you know, there've been varying degrees of success with that. Here's a thing that Raj Gupta taught me, and I've experienced it, but I couldn't articulate it until he showed it to me, and that is, if you're going to, in order to grow beyond 200, you need to acknowledge less relational connectedness in the church. Raj showed me that there's an English anthropologist by the name of Robin Dunbar who has come up with a theory that church growth guys have leapt onto, and actually corporates in America have also leapt onto it, and it's become known now as Dunbar's number. And what Dunbar has recognized is that an ordinary person cannot meaningfully interact with more than 150 people. So even if you've got 5,000 friends on Facebook, they've done Facebook studies on this. Even if you've got thousands or hundreds of friends on Facebook, you actually only meaningfully interact with not more than 150 of those people. And that is kind of the recognized anthropological limit of our relational capacity. He thinks it's related to the size of our brain, and he studied primates, and they've got a lower number because their brains are smaller. But Dunbar's number is a very helpful tool for us to think about with regards to church and church growth. If it's true that you can only meaningfully be connected to not more than 150 people, it does mean that you need to think about appointing staff when you get to that level, or just before you get to that level. And what church growth analysts have noticed is that there's actually there's the principle of diminishing returns. So if you get to 300 in your church, you don't only need two staff members, you need four. And apparently now in the big churches in America, the optimal ratio of staff to members is 1 to 76 to keep it growing. And so that was a helpful thing to acknowledge less relational connectedness, which you will also cop flack for, because people who used to be connected with you now have to be connected to people around you, and are grumpy about that sometimes. And so recently we've been copping flack for that as well. And so acknowledging that, organizing smaller, so small groups become a key factor in your church, so that people do feel connected and loved and cared for. But relational connectedness has got to change, or else you will stay at 150. And I think that that involves an educational process with the congregation, helping them to change their expectations and realizing that, you know, I might not be the person that visits you in hospital, but your home group leader will, and that kind of thing. And some people will leave. Some of the church literature puts it like this, which is a familiar term to us, I think, is moving from shepherd to rancher. That is raising up other shepherds who can do more work collectively than you could do on your own because of Dunbar's number and that limitation that we all have. Painful but necessary, and expect people to oppose and expect people to leave. Some other things, and I think we're failing actually in this area at the moment, and it's coming into the spotlight for us as a team, and we're trying to work out what to do, but more formal assimilation and communication is a key thing. So developing a pipeline that is clear, a pathway that is clear, from a car park to full-blown member of the church, so working out what that pipeline is, resourcing that pipeline, staffing it, with volunteers and full-timers is a key thing. One of the key things that we've done recently and seen results from is increasing the quality of services and programs in our church, making an investment in music. So we've recently appointed a music director who's been here this week. He's not here this morning. And that has been a quantum leap for us as a church, from a production point of view and increasing the quality of the services point of view. I think Ray Galea last year when he was with us said every Sunday needs to be a big match Sunday. And so we've taken that on board. We've tried to put our best foot forward every Sunday to increase the quality of services and other programs. Thinking about things that evangelicals don't often think about, like what is the vibe of the meeting when you walk in? So developing, you know, we've got a couple of people who help us think about vibe in the building. I mean, I haven't found that in the Bible anyway, but it's made a difference, you know, because people pick that up. It's a sociological thing, not a theological thing necessarily. We've also noticed that we've had to change our decision-making structure. So as you get bigger, the staff team become more of the decision makers than the church council do. And that has caused trouble. It's caused conflict. But because the staff team are on the ground at the rock face, we've had to transition in that direction and retool our council to accept that, to agree with that, to oversee it still from a governance point of view, but to be willing for the staff to make decisions on the ground, when necessary. So, those are some of the things that we've noticed. I'm sure there's a lot more to be said, and the other guys in the room are much better qualified to talk about this than me. I want to end with a. I'll tell you a story that happened to us recently at church, just because it's exciting and different. And then I think we might have time for Q&A. And is that right, Murray? What time do we end? Does anybody know? End at 11. So we could have other guys talk to some of these things as well. 3 weeks before Easter, if you've been to our church, you'll know that on the north side is a Hindu temple. On the south side is a mosque. Behind the mosque are two churches. One is a prosperity church, and the other is a dying Baptist church. About 20 people that go on a Sunday. And there's a plot opposite our church that is now being developed, and I've just noticed a sign which says, Hosanna Church coming soon. Because the one thing our area needs is another church. So we're in this kind of food court of religion in where we are. And we've made quite good friends with the Hindus because we need their parking. And we've reciprocated by letting them use our parking from time to time. And the Hindus, it's quite difficult to use their parking because I don't know if you knew this about Hindus, but they don't. Because they operate on the cycle of the moon, their meetings are not predictable. So they don't meet like every Friday like the Muslims do. You know? So it's a little bit tricky to work it out, but basically we use their parking on most Sundays unless they have a meeting. And the Hindu temple is rented by three different Hindu sects. So it's the Umhlanga Hindu Society, own the building, and then there are three different sects that meet it and share the facilities. And one of the sects is the Sai Baba Society, the Sai Society. I don't know if you know who Sai is. He's a guru, a Hindu guru. He died about 6 years ago. He's often on the painted on the back of buses wearing an orange dress with a big afro, if you've seen him like that. And he was deified, really, and he's, there's a whole movement around the world. And Kevin is the lead elder of the Sai Society, and he phoned me 3 weeks before Easter, and he said, "Grant, you know that we think that all religions lead to the top of the mountain." I said, "Yes." He said, "For that reason, we'd like to bring some of our people to one of your services. Would that be all right?" I said, "How many people?" He said, "We'd like to bring 100, if that's okay. Can you accommodate us?" I said, "We'd love to have you. But Kevin, some of your people might become Christians and join us." He said, "We don't mind. It's all the same." So the Sunday before Easter, we had 100 Hindus turn up at our early morning service, all dressed in white with a picture of Sai on their T-shirts. And they came and sat in the middle row, the best behaved children I've ever seen in my life. Put us to complete shame. And we got to preach the gospel to them. It was a wonderful occasion. And what was wonderful was not only that there were 100 pagans that we could preach the gospel to, but the response of our church was so wonderful to it. People left the services that they normally go to come to that service so that they could be involved in hospitality and hosting and bringing food. Everybody was engaged afterwards. We basically had to ask them to leave because the second service was about to start, in order to get rid of them. And the response from them was such warmth that as I finished preaching and got off the stage, one of the other leaders came up to me and said, "We'd really like to hear more about this. Would you mind coming to our meeting on Thursday night? And could you speak for 15 minutes on what Easter means to Christians?" And I said, "I'd love to come, but I need 20 minutes. And she said, "That's fine." And so we went along. We took 15 people from our church across, left our shoes at the door. Women sat on the left, men on the right, listened to the most ghastly music for 45 minutes. And then stood up and preached Christ for 20 minutes. It was wonderful. There were no conversions that I know of. But there was a wonderful warmth between us, and we're hoping that relationship will develop. Some of the Hindus who came to the service the week before, to our service, were sitting taking notes. I had a few of them come up to me to say, "Do you mind if we come back to church?" We said, "We'd love to have you." And I'm aware that one came back over the Easter, at one of our services over the Easter weekend. But who knows what'll come of that. It was a great opportunity. Praise God for that.